As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast. It's me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
On today's cast, we're jumping into the Fleets of the Imperium for the second time, because we've recorded this before. And yeah, we're doing it again because my audio didn't come through. And
like, as much as you're trying to make the difficulty level come up, because you were like, Brad, how are you feeling that time? And I was like, really good, John. We should rock this. We're super excited about everything. And then John went, hey, how are you today? And I'm like, I got hit by a bus. He's like, yeah, we don't have any audio.
The 40K Lorecast is a weekly podcast focused on the lore of the Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern time. If you like the show, please comment on it and like it. And following us on Spotify and or whatever you listen on really does help us. Additionally, we have now launched a Patreon for our fans. The Patreon simply gives you access to the show ad-free for $4.99 US. I'm going to take the time to learn them in other nationalities because that's what most of our Patreons actually are. And then I'll start quoting those. Also, in the show notes, you'll see links to our merchandise, but more importantly, to our Discord. We have a wonderful Discord that I could not be more proud of, despite constantly threatening to burn to the ground if it ever ceases to be amazing. But our Discord is designed for all of our listeners in mind. It is meant to be a place that people who find 40K interesting and enjoyable can go and interact in a healthy environment to get advice for hobbying, painting, reading. It's also it really is the best place, unless you know, see me on the street, to explain, to talk to me about the casts themselves. So Brad and I are both in there a ton, so please join. Big thank you to Query, Cthulhu, Gersback, Noogle, Steve, Doc, Maestro, Snaz, and Solarzia for moderating that Discord. They're doing a hell of a job keeping it not just moderated in the sense of, you know, what we allow, don't allow, but also keeping it organized and structured. It really is a very easy to interact with Discord. Let's talk about ships, because it's cool. Last week, we covered how warp travel is done, all the components to it, and then some of the structure lightly of the Imperium. This week, we want to spend a bit more time onto kind of two main parts of it. First is going to be the merchant fleet, which is the largest, and then the Imperial Navy, which I think has the bigger play in the lore. That's why we structured it that way.
The merchant fleet isn't just bigger. It's like saying that I'm slightly shorter than the Empire State Building. The merchant fleet is a massive, massive fleet. And we're going to go into it more and more, but it has the most diverse elements amongst our weaponry, includes such diverse elements as, and if you don't know that reference, what are you doing with your life? But also, there's just so many ships, because this is the people that do everything for the Imperium, from bringing widgets to food to making sure everybody doesn't die.
Yep. And so the way that the Imperium is structured, as we covered in the last fleet, is it's broke up into segmentums. Some of them are kind of fun, like the Soul Segmentum, and some of them are nightmare zones, like the Ultima Segmentum.
Ugh.
But in each segmentum, travel and trade moves through within the merchant fleet. And it's controlled in each section by what's called a segmentum fortress. And a segmentum fortress is the hub of all trade, but also all military. And we'll get to them in a minute in this portion of the galaxy. So the merchant fleet, the Navy fleets, civilian fleets, inquisitorial fleets, Admex, Space Marines, all of them interact with a segmentum fortress. Think of it like air traffic control for the entire segmentum.
Yes.
Because they want to know who everyone is and where they're going.
Air traffic control, but you're always flying into a military zone. Because if you do not respond back, they're most commonly just blowing you up.
Yeah, and let's jump into the segmentum fortresses. So the segmentum fortress itself, as Brad was just saying, this is a fortress in a Imperium that is on a war footing. So that these segmentum fortresses, first and foremost, are a full-blown naval fortress. This is not, it is a trading depot, but it's a trading depot surrounded by the largest military force you'll ever see, possibly in the history of the galaxy.
Yeah, but I was just about to say, these are fortresses, and you just think, oh, it's a fortress. No, these are mobile moon/planets that are fortified with every possible weapon, every possible defense. Also, surrounded by a ton of large ships. They have everything from battleships to frigates. Everything are all around these because these are such wildly important hubs. They also have a ton of everything you need to resupply, from food to resources to fuel to actual troops and people to get into your ships. One of the biggest things about these fortresses, they are ready to resupply a huge amount of fleets and everything else, because they have to be. We're in a war society. Like, the entire economy is based on war. When things go badly, which they frequently do, even though we tell everyone we win every single battle, this has supplies, be it munitions, be it people. And that includes, they actually have extra astropath navigators in here that are for other ships. They basically can have the ability to poach navigators and astropaths because almost every big ship has extras because of the fact that, especially if you're in Obscurus, that's one of the biggest things that the Chaos Forces try to do. They're experts at trying to cripple ships by just killing the astropaths and killing navigators.
Exactly. And it gives you a hub situation to build off of, because it's exactly your point. If all of a sudden a battleship, and we'll cover them later, loses its navigator, you don't want to then not be able to use the battleship for a while. This way you can actually either, you know, if it's nearby, you can come back to the hub, or more importantly, you can throw the extra navigator on a frigate and fire the frigate really quickly over to the battleship to then, you know, resupply effectively. So these things, because again, when we talked about the segmentums, they're meant to all operate almost independently.
I mean, it's not even almost independent. It's pretty much independent unless Bobby G shows up or old Solar Macarius type things shows up, you're operating independently of each other.
All right. Another key thing about these fortresses, though, is they're also used for trading. As we said, within the segmentums, all the trade occurs, but there are some supplies that have to go back to Sol, like Impossibilium or whatever, you know, it's not adamantium.
Impossibilium.
Because there's plenty of adamantium, obviously.
There's not enough unobtainium, though.
Unobtainium, that's the one I'm thinking of. I said Impossibilium, I know there was one in there, unobtainium. So those ones have to go back to Sol, but those are very special, or not just Sol, even other segments. Those are very special journeys. So these fortresses serve as a holding point for those ones. So stuff comes in, gets loaded up, and then the ships that do those travels, that's where they come through. Obviously, these are very critical fortresses. This is also why they tend to be positioned in really key areas. For example, in Sol, the fortress sits right above Mars. Why? Because it's the biggest and most important trading hub, that's what it really is, in the entire Imperium. In Obscurus, it sits there, there's a forge world named Cypra Mundi, and Cypra Mundi is one of the largest forge worlds in the galaxy.
You were really not giving its justice. It's big. It's not Necromunda, but it's still big.
It might be number two behind Necromunda, and Necromunda's got a lot of issues, if we're being honest. So this is where position really? These fortresses. Yeah. So each fortress is ruled by a pair of individuals. The first one is called the Administrata Master. This person is just a pure bureaucrat. They oversee all the logistics.
I think that they're bots, to be honest. So I really think that no matter what, because everybody's enhanced that does any of these things. So these guys have to, they're bureaucrats and you're putting them down a little bit, but man, they are in charge of, yes, like just a crazy amount of data.
Oh, yeah. They are bureaucrats, but their job is to oversee all the logistics moving around their system. So this is air traffic control, police officer, Coast Guard, everything, all rolled into one. Interestingly, though, their job is to enforce all the rules and regulations, but they don't have the ability to grant overrides or anything at that level. That has to come back from the main administratum. So, you know, for example, if you are operating within the segmentum, it's not this individual who gives you your charter. That still has to come all the way back from the main administratum. But this is the individual who would say, you know, your driver's license is not valid. That's basically, that's kind of their job. Now, also on the same fortress, though, is the inverse of this person. This person will come up more later. It's the Lord High Admiral. The Lord High Admiral is a naval officer, and they're the highest ranking naval officer in the entire segment at this point. They have ultimate authority over the area. They decide, you know, where the naval fleet goes. They decide in the engagements. They decide the movement of troops. They can even, they actually do believe can override charters, if I'm not mistaken. They have pure, unadulterated power. And this is because each Lord High Admiral, they're ranked out by segment. The highest ranking Lord High Admiral is the one, is the Lord High Admiral for the Sol system. That person's a High Lord of Terra. The mildly strong position versus Captain Bureaucracy on the other side.
Yeah, true.
Now, with that setup, I wanted to kind of dive a bit more into the merchant fleet, start kind of zeroing in on what makes up the merchant fleet. So you have inside a segment, the merchant fleet itself operates. And then within that segment, there is one administrator who watches over it. But the actual breakdown of it is kind of interesting to me. So every single ship in the entire Imperium has to have some sort of charter on it. Now, your charter could be a rogue trader charter, a warrant of trade. It could be inquisitorial, space marine, arbite, admech. They each have their own. And that the same is true for the merchants, which is called a fleet charter, also known as forklift certified for the Imperial, for the Imperial Galaxy.
You drive.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's more impressive than someone who's not forklift certified, but it's forklift certified. What a fleet charter gives you the ability to do is it simply means you can be the captain of a ship, but that ship, you don't really get much say over any over where it goes because you're the captain of a ship that's part of a fleet.
This is a big deal because they actually stated in some of the writings that the fleet commander, whoever's leading this, can strip them of their title as a captain and it'll be revoked and they give it to another person, but they can do that at any time. So like if you're standing there and the fleet commander decides you're not doing a good job, they do the whole punch. Who's the head grip? Punch that head grip. Right in the face. Hard. So Les Grossman gets to tell him what's going on while he's doing his dance. But like these guys just get shot sometimes. Hey, you got delayed in the warp. This is for sure your fault. First in command, shoot guy in the face. He's not. You're the captain now. He does a Vader on him.
Yes. 100%. And so, because that's what all these guys are. They're just a guy who's allowed to be the captain according to the administratum. But this person has no say over the trade routes that they go or anything. Basically, flying the small ship near the big ship that's got the guy who has the real charter on it.
But you're also, you're the fall guy. Let's be honest. With a lot of these guys.
A lot of times. Yeah, a lot of these guys are fall guys. But let's get to one that's actually interesting. So in ranking, these guys are the next up from the bottom, but I find them the most interesting. And it's called the free charter.
These guys are awesome. This is one of the many things that I think that Cavill's 40K show could be around, because these guys show up everywhere.
The free charter is a charter given to a captain of an independent vessel that's not part of a larger fleet. This independent person is allowed to do kind of whatever they want with their vessel within reason, obviously. So they decide where they go. And what that means is they actually are truly, they're a merchant. They're going out there finding out, well, Planet X needs someone to take goods over to Planet Q, and they're willing to pay this much for it. But Planet F is willing to pay this much to take stuff to Planet E. And this becomes their goal, because a key thing about this is that the Imperium itself, trade within the Imperium occurs on mostly a very macro scale. We are moving food, water, supplies for the military footing.
Lots of weapons.
Yeah. And that's what this is. Everything's designed around, hey, we've got this mining world on Planet Y, and they are mining all day, and we need a fleet of ships to take stuff from that to a forge world. These guys don't touch that. What these guys do touch is on planet, you know, Mercurial, they have actual beef, and very wealthy people would like to eat that beef. They don't make enough beef for the Imperium to really create a trade route for them. So these free charter guys would then be the ones who take those from one place to another.
And it's a big deal, because they're going, hey, everybody can eat corpse starch. We're not restricting it to only be corpse starch, but also, as long as everyone's alive there, we just don't care at all. I mean, whoa. To be fair, I went too far for the Imperium. They said everybody's alive there. What I meant to say was, as long as they're still meeting their quotas, I don't care. So,
yeah. But I think, Brad, my love of this also may come from the fact that we both played Wing Commander Privateer back in the day,
yeah,
which I just looked up and discovered when it came out. And
30
that
years
didn't
ago.
Make me, no, it's
is it more?
It's more.
Oof.
Well, actually, barely more. It's 32 years ago.
I like this, though, because this makes me think of that, but it also makes me think of Firefly. You know, this is where you can get the, even though the Imperium's a nightmare, this is where the excitement comes from. Because these guys also get into some shenanigans, because you're talking about very small level operators that are a lot of times taking the dangerous things. These are also the things that pirates want to hit, because you're taking a expensive good that also, if you don't make it, the Imperium's not super like the actual Imperium. They're not even, they'll take care of they don't want piracy, but also like the actual food got there. You just didn't get the better food there.
Yeah. And my guess is there's a little bit of this, like the game Starfield comes into play in this a little bit too. There's a few little different ways that this one can manifest itself. So the free charters are super cool. Beyond the free charters, you get to what's called the Heredity Charter. And these ones are both good and bad. So the Heredity Charter is a trading charter that can then be passed down from generations. So you and your family are now ship captains.
There's two things. I mean, we'll go into the bad, we'll go into the good, because these also have a lot of disparity between them, because a Heredity Charter is often some of these families are bananas rich. You're talking about,
yes,
you know, the Hiltons and all this, you know what I mean?
The key thing about a Heredity Charter, though, is that unlike the free charter we just covered, where they can go anywhere they want, the Heredity Charter means you and your ancestors can take the following route, you know, world A to world D. That's it. That's for the rest of your family's existence. You are going to trade from world A to world D. There may be a couple extra routes in there, but effectively that's what you do. The problem with that is that sometimes world A or world D ceases to be a place you want to be going to. And the Imperium doesn't really care about that, because your charter says world A to world D. And if world D becomes an awakened tomb world, then you and all of your family, and until you run out of ancestors, will continue to fly your ships to that Necron tomb world. I don't know. Maybe you get lucky. Maybe, you know, Trays in the Infinite will decide to trade with you instead of blowing you out of the sky.
In my mind, I do have, like, usually you get a lot of people killed, but occasionally the Necrons just go, all right, what's actually in this shit, man? This is crazy that you're doing this. So screw it. Let's just check it out.
After the 50th ship has shown up, they've blown out of the sky. They're like, all right, fine. Like, how much? They're just looking up there like, do you take whatever currency we invented 65 million years ago? Is this still working? Is this a gold doubloon? Can we use those?
Like, you just have to think that they just get so confused that they might just go, all right, it just works.
Like, fine. Like, you know, it's just, this feels mean at this point. But that's the Heredity Charter. The next tier up from them is the Ultimate. This is basically the best you're going to do outside of being a rogue trader. And this is the Heredity Free Charter. Now, the Heredity Free Charter is very rare. This is only given to people who operate large fleets themselves. These are very powerful families that usually have had to use the wealth they've gained to get influence all the way back to the Lords of Terra to get this type of thing.
You know, I have the best analogy for this. I actually think this is like the spice traders for Dune. This is one of the major houses, and this is a hereditary free charter. When you get this, you are unbelievably wealthy. You have a lot of power because they don't give these to up and coming merchant, you know, this scrappy dude.
Oh, no.
You have to have, they have small, I can't even say small, they have military fleets of their own to protect the fleets. These are given to powerful houses that can take care of themselves and are given, just like the spice and Dune, a very important role of transporting things.
No, it's a great analogy. And so one of the key differences I want to point out between the Heredity Free Charter and the Heredity Charter is the Heredity Charter is linked to a trade route. The Heredity Free Charter, you still end up linked to a trade route, but you bid on it and they can change. In the example I used before, where one of the worlds you're going to became a Necron Tomb world, everyone with a Heredity Charter would die. The Heredity Free Charter would be able to say, yeah, I'm not going there anymore. And they could then bid for other routes and they could then get them. And therefore, these are, to Brad's point, these become flotillas. I mean, we are talking massive British East Indian Tea Company. That would have been a Heredity Free Charter.
I think you're going for more like the Quarians floating around with their flotilla.
No, but the Flarians don't do trade. Stop trying to wedge. Don't. Not really.
You will accept the Quarians are awesome and Tally's the best companion you can have.
We both know that's not true. Like, we both.
Whatever. Your probably favorite's Jacob.
I just play the whole game. Jacob or die. You got to roll Jacob. Now, doesn't everyone use the sniper and the big angry reptile? Yeah.
Like, the big angry reptile. You're talking. It's Rex, but I just love the big angry reptile.
Yeah. And did anything I say make you not think of Rex?
No, it's Garrison Rex. But it's
perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. I described Garrison Rex perfectly. Look at that. Look at me go. All right. But let's talk about the merchant fleet experience, though. As we talked about before, the merchant fleet functions in a lot of ways the way intercontinental trade on Earth happened in the 16th and 19th centuries. GW needed a good influence, and it was just sitting there. So as colonies are built up around the globe, trade exploded. And this is on Earth. The main thing about that, as this trade exploded, for a lot of the citizenry, a lot more money is made on moving of the goods around the globe than there was actually creating the goods back at home. So you start getting this massive independent merchant fleet start popping up all around the world.
We have to go for a little bit of why, though. Because in 40K, the Imperium has made certain worlds, and we've talked about this in previous casts, wildly more than any other civilization or even race. We've made certain planets completely not viable unless an Imperium exists around it. We have planets that don't provide any food, or they have no food or water on the planet. It's just a completely...
It's just a barren wasteland of manufacture.
Right. Yep. And we have to have these planets supplied with food and water and everything else. And also we have a ton of these other planets that not only do they not have that, they also don't have the raw materials anymore. So they get sent all of Rock A. They get sent all the unobtainium they can possibly do because their planet only makes tanks, exactly. guns, whatever. So, like, we have to have these merchants moving things from point A to point B because we've isolated these planets of you only do this. Now, wildly, it's kind of actually bananas efficient for a war economy. It's terribly inefficient for anything else because you want to just have these guys put out lasgun rifles, whatever they're making. You get them here and you destroy them, go.
I think a cool thing about this, the merchant fleet is made up largely of volunteers. In fact, almost exclusively of volunteers who want to take part in this trade Brad was just talking about in order to keep the Imperium alive because they can make a lot of money. But there isn't that much money in it. And when the reason I bring that up is these merchant fleets, what makes them so lucrative, what makes it such a way to make money is you don't have navigators. You don't have astropaths. You barely have Geller fields, like not strong ones.
It depends on the size. If you're talking the Hereditary, some of those just have navigator houses hitched to them.
98%, 99% do not.
It's like and businesses so, are right now. You have giant businesses. Exactly. You have, but the majority are. And this is one of the reasons why I think that we talked about the fortresses in Ig Segmentum. Why those people are so powerful is they have all this information that might not even make its way back to Terra and the Lords of Terra in this. That's these guys have such a huge position because they're in charge of all of this.
Exactly. And so the life on these ships, that's why I wanted to talk about, is interesting to me because what you have is these fleets are jumping across the galaxy. Even the free charter guys, they're sitting there, you know, trying to get as much trade as they can in a lifetime. But some of these trips can take a while because you're doing blind hops. So it could be a 6-week journey. It could be a 2-year journey to bring this stuff across. And not just like 2 years hanging out safely traveling. It's 2 years of ducking pirates, doing warp jumps, readjusting yourself, all of these things.
For John's point on this, it's such a big deal because what the Imperium does is, hey, I need to send whatever to Planet D. Well, I know that these warp jumps are, some ships are going to not make it. Some ships are going to take too long. So the Imperium just loads up a bunch of ships either every week, every day, every couple months, and they just sling a whole bunch of them out there and some of them stick. And then we keep
going. Well, and that's actually some of that's crazy too, where you might be at a port city. You and the ship next to you, you know, you're drinking at the bar and you're both getting loaded with the same supplies to go to the same place. And you might get there 4 years before they do, 3 years after they do, or they may never arrive. And you just know that. But the odds of the two of you leaving at the same time, translating to the warp at the same time and arriving at the same time is non-existent.
It has to be one of my favorite, just Brad canon. They don't even have a ton of stories for this, is you get sent with war gear. You need to get here with the resources to fight this. And then you get lost in the warp and you show up and they're like, hey man, that was done for a couple hundred years now.
They're like, son of a bitch. Who are you?
Yeah,
exactly.
Also, why do you have this? We haven't needed any of this for forever. This is vital for the war. You like that ended like a long time ago, man.
So one of the things that's cool about this is that as these ships come into port and move to the next spot, they pick up these ship hands, and the ship hands are there to do a number of different things. Sometimes it's just a person who just hates the world they're on and wants to go to another one. So they're effectively hitchhiking across the galaxy, but they're working in order to get there. Again, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Maybe the best sci-fi book ever written. What happens, though, is that over time, some end up joining the ships and never leaving. What ends up happening is that this creates almost a new civilization that lives amongst the stars. They don't live on planets. And they over time are called the Voidborn.
These are really interesting to me because they start to get highly specialized. You saw a little bit of it in The Expanse with the Belters. By the way, if you haven't seen The Expanse, go get that. It's fantastic. Also, the books are good too. But in 40K, the Voidborn become wildly specialized and also highly adept at what they're supposed to be doing. A lot of these, well, let's go farther into this.
Yeah, let's talk about the Voidborn. I think the Voidborn are really cool because they do appear in novels and games a lot. So I want to spend some time talking about them to answer some questions people have, like, what is a Voidborn? So a Voidborn is not just someone who's born on a spaceship. This happens all the time. We're doing multi-year journeys. You're going to have sex and make kids. That's going to happen.
But these are, the Voidborn are people. This is a culture of
Voidborn. Yeah. That's why I use the term civilization. I think the Voidborn are their own mini civilization within the Imperium, because the Voidborn are only live in space. They'll touch down on a planet for a short period of time. The thing about the Voidborn being born generation to generation in space, according to GW, this is enough time for them to actually evolve to be more spacefaring. Now, GW admits it's because of radiation and exposure to warp, because you don't evolve in like 1,000 years, guys, but whatever. What makes them interesting about that is that they're also somewhat abhuman, because they look like a being that only lives in space.
So the Voidborn are thinner. They're gaunt. They also are heavily, they're mutated, but they're also heavily augmented for whatever it is that they do on the ship. So you see actually different levels of the ship. They do a great job of this in Rogue Trader, the game, and they have a lot of short stories about this in Travel in the Inquisition books, which is you have these very tall, very gaunt, but very heavily augmented to. And you can tell, like, a couple of the books talk about the Inquisitors meeting some of these Voidborn and instantly know that they are from this particular section of the ship, because they have the augments to work on this part of the ship. And they are also, I have to give them credit. This is pretty cool. They have, their families are on these same ships for thousands of years sometimes, and they have heavily modified the ship also, because they have to make this thing work through, you know, generation and generation and generation.
Yeah. And this is what makes the Voidborn so interesting, because they're both shunned and embraced by the Imperium. It basically is, where do you live? If you live on a planet, you don't like the Voidborn, because to Brad's point, they're odd looking. And they also, the thing too, we should also mention, is they also don't like being on planet. Should mention, these are people who live their entire lives living in bulkheads of spaceships. Suddenly standing a planet, aside from the fact that gravity starts crushing their bones immediately, they are
terrifying. Oh God.
I admit I'm claustrophobic. You put me in a small confined space, I don't really like it. These people are the inverse. They've only ever been in a small confined space. Then you put them somewhere where the sky never ends and they just freak out. So it means a lot of times what I like about this is that their interactions with people on planets are largely negative, because they're freaked out at the time. They're basically having a panic attack and are incredible amounts of pain. And when they talk to anybody, so they don't really get along very well. However, the Imperial Navy and anyone who works kind of in orbit loves the Voidborn, because to Brad's point, they are masters of this technology. And a family would, for example, within a hive or most of the Imperium, where you're born is where you will die, unless you join the guard. The Voidborn, what they do is they're going to be born, let's say, near the engine compartment, for example. They and their entire family will work on that engine. That's all they've ever done for generations. They're better at work on that engine than anyone. There's even stories of the Admech coming down into the bowels of ships to meet with the Voidborn to learn how some of the technology works, because the Admech have a schematic for an engine. Then they look at said engine and say, that's not the schematic anymore. It's because it's been modified over the years by the Voidborn. The Voidborn push the mechanicum in their knowledge.
And the thing is that a lot of times these ships are thousands of years old, and they've been in constant active duty, especially on a lot of these military. I mean, on the military ships, 100%. But a lot of these Rogue Trader ships and some of these larger hereditary ships and stuff like that, you've been doing these routes since when was the ship christened? M32, and it's still in it, operation right now and it's still running, and you go, hey, let's, I've got the schematics for the ship, and you go, this doesn't look like anything.
So this is why in games, if you are a Voidborn, it actually gives you a bonus to your ship's performance. Because the thing with the Voidborn is this knowledge they have is tends to also just be spaceship knowledge. Because the Voidborn don't just serve in the bowels of a merchant vessel or even the bowels of a naval vessel. They will become naval commanders. They will become breachers. They will take on numerous roles. You know, some of them may become rogue traders with time. They can get a lot of power, and they are masters of space because it's all that they know. They're masters of ships. You get some cool stories where, like, you'd have something going wrong on a ship, but luckily a random guy on the ship is Voidborn and just kind of runs over and fixes it while the Imperial mechanics are struggling.
Oh, that's why great. The Voidborn are cool. And they're fantastic for, especially again, in the dark space, you know, dark future, there is only war. These guys are great for combat fixes.
Yes.
They're just like, yeah, whatever, man. My whole family's been, for the last couple hundred thousands of years, whatever, we are all Voidborn. Yeah, of course we fix this stuff because we had to know how to fix it because everybody dies if you don't. And I love some of the stories about the Voidborn are great because they just assume that other people have this knowledge. So they're like, of course you do this. And they're like, nobody knew this.
Yeah. But actually, let's take up, because from the Voidborn, let's go into the Imperial Navy. I think that's a good transition because a lot of the Voidborn are also part of this.
Yes.
The Imperial Navy. The funny thing about this is, in the scheme of ships that make up all of the Imperium, the merchant makes up about 90 to 92% of all ships are under the merchant fleet. About 5% of that overall 100% is made up by the Imperial Navy. The Imperial Navy is 3 to 10 times the size of the Imperial Guard. So this is the largest force that the Imperium has by a wide margin is the Imperial
Navy. Let's talk about a little bit of why, though. Because the casualty rate, for one, is wildly lower. Because, yes, we lose ships. Yes, we have space battles. But the Imperium's general the modus of operandus is shove Imperial Guardsmen into a wood chipper until it jams the wood chipper. We don't do that with ships because, well, ships cost money. Arrows cost money.
That's why. That's what I was going to say. The las gun and the quote-unquote flak armor, very heavy, quote-unquote, on the armor word there, don't cost very much, and the person costs even less. The ship's expensive.
Right.
So we could wage naval combat where we could keep the ship and lose all the crew. They do that all day, every day. Yeah. But they can't.
If they could start firing naval as bullets. Yeah.
Then we're good, but we'll keep this going. So as a result, the Imperial Navy is a lot larger. And also, you know, the ships are a lot bigger too. They had to carry a lot more stuff. Before we do that, I want to talk a bit more about some of the structure of the Imperial Navy, because it's broken up into segments in the galaxy. So each segmentum has its own Lord High Admiral. Each High Lord Commander commands their battle fleet, which is made up of 100 vessels.
Asterisk.
Yes, big asterisk there. Brad's correct. There's a big asterisk here. Let's say 100 vessels. That's 100 vessels of note. It doesn't include all the small little guys. So it's 100 battleships, cruisers, and frigates. That's what they have. And some places there can actually be more than that. And within this structure, their job is to keep their segmentum safe with that. So less than 50% of their battle fleet is around the fortress at any time. The rest of it's out on patrol. Depending on what the segmentum is and what the region is, the size of that patrol will vary. And this is because they're responsible for pirates. They're responsible for small enemy incursions. All of this, it has to get handled. It has to get handled quick. If you allow pirates to kind of get a hold of a system, then you're going to have to require a lot more muscle to deal with them later. But
so they're supposed to nip these in the bud, because if you have to radio out, I love that I'm going radio for this. If you have to radio out that you need some help, the bigger guys in charge are annoyed that they have to stop pushing the crusade forward and unify the galaxy and come back to deal with the thing that you need help with. And this is a big deal on that.
And let's talk about the two biggest ones you're going to have here. It's going to be orcs and Drukhari. So, and I kind of want to break this down a little bit so people understand why these exploratory fleets matter. If you've got a small orc incursion occurring and you just slap it down hard, then it doesn't draw other orcs the battle because the battle is over. There's no problems anymore. It's the same with Drukhari. If Drukhari raid an area and they don't get a lot of resistance, they'll hit it harder and harder each time. And when you finally do want to go deal with them, you may find yourself with a much larger raiding force than the small little incursion ones.
It might be a cabal leading multiple other cabals and covens and which, you know.
Yeah.
But if you're if you make it difficult, they just look for somewhere else.
They don't bother. And the flip side, though, is you also might encounter an awakening tomb world or, fine, you hit Tau space, you know, but or something like, you know, where you do hit like an Eldar craft world. In those scenarios, you're going to get smoked no matter what. So you don't want to have a large force, because imagine if you had like a larger battle group that all of a sudden finds itself above, what's the Stormlord's Necron tomb world?
Yeah, he's the Sawtek.
Sawtek, yeah. So yeah, it's, all of a sudden you sit there and it's a Sawtek. You're done. And that's something where you need to go bring a full crusade into. You don't want to lose a bunch of ships just because you made a wrong turn at Albuquerque.
Which does happen.
There's an old reference for Brad.
Yes. Thanks, Bugs.
Just should have turned left. So that's why these patrols are so important. But they also have to do other tasks. Escort duty. So when the AdMech exploratory fleets go out, I mean, the AdMech make them their ships. So the deal AdMech has is, we will make you all the battleships. But when our exploratory ships go out looking for STCs, in which case, by the way, they always cause problems when they do that, it's the job of the Imperial Navy to escort them and make sure that they get their STCs back home safe.
Let's talk about one of the others. When an important person has to go from point A to point B, they have to be escorted. But also, half the time, it's about 50% other things and 50%, oh yeah, the Lords of Terra are terrible. So they're probably trying to kill some of their rivals because they left their fortified base for 8 seconds.
Another big piece the Imperial Navy has to do is actually escort their own craft, their new craft. So Forge World, for example, as we said earlier, is going to build a battleship. But a Forge World is primarily housed with the Adeptus Mechanicus. That they don't have a million troops just sitting around waiting to go on it. So they have to then collect it and then bring it back to the fortress, where at the fortress it'll get staffed with people. The problem, obviously, is that, you know, they don't have enough crew in it to fire the guns or do all that stuff.
When they have Big Earl and his barbershop quartet trying to get the ship from point A to point B. Not a lot of people are ready to staff these. The population of some of these giant vessels is crazy to make these things.
Very much so. Very, very much. But what I will say is, from that, though, I do want to have some fun. Let's transition, because we just talked about Imperial war vessels, into the Imperial Navy at war. Because I find this part, and again, it's because I enjoyed Battlefleet Gothic a lot, but also they have this within Traitor and a bunch of other ones. It's a super fun thing. So let's talk about
Let me put my pinkies out real quick and talk about the Imperium and its theaters of war.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
The holidays are almost here. And if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful. With thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else, you'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods is a fantastic collection of products that are unique, funny, and clever. Add some personalization to your holiday shopping with Uncommon Goods. For me, the holidays are full of family and entertaining, which is a lot easier with a combo of a robust bar and weird games to play. So after Fart Bingo and a Whiskey Smoker, I decided to double down on some infusers and a game called Poorly Explained Movies. Hopefully, this will get me through it. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, diehard sports fans to foodies. You'll find thousands of gifts of new ideas that you won't find anywhere else. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/40klore. That's uncommongoods.com. That's uncommongoods.com/40klore for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
40K Lorecast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings may vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Yeah, so the Imperium has two styles of engagement. Style one is space-to-space combat. Style two is space-to-surface combat. One of them is very easy to cover and talk about. Put ship in orbit, fire guns with gravity at thing. Not complicated. The bigger one, though, is the ship-to-ship combat. And for those of you, by the way, who play the game and are wondering why I'm so into this, check out Battlefleet Gothic. It's a really cool turn-based style, and it covers this well. Let's talk about the equipment on these ships here so you understand how grand a scale this combat is. And we'll start with defense. The first one is what's called, because these actually also come up on the tabletop a little bit, void shields. I want to talk about what a void shield is.
Can we, okay, do the void shields, but I really want to talk about, you know, let me jump in after that. Because I'm all excited. John's holding me back. He's basically doing the big brother with the little brother. He's got his hand on my head. Because I want to talk about how big stuff is.
Yeah, Brad likes the offense. I like defense. It actually is why we work well. Although not when I play the game, because I just run my orcs forward. It's easy. I have strategy.
Anyway, I was just about to say that. Why bother?
Just orcs go that way. Anyway, what's my deployment zone? What's my opponent's deployment zone? Cool, I'm going that way. All right. So the first thing I talk about is a void shield. And a void shield is the force field of 40K. But they explain how it works. It's a Geller field in reverse. Whereas a Geller field projects bubble of materium around the ship, and including the ship itself, a void shield projects a layer of immaterium all around the ship. And that way, when something from the materium, like a shell or a last cannon blast or whatever, interacts with it, like a matter-antimatter, it explodes and deflects the blow. The thing I like about them a lot is that they require constant energy to keep in place. And the more these impacts, interactions happen, the more energy gets pulled.
I love that you're like constant energy. Like you need like that diesel generator you got. No, these are massive, massive amounts of power because as we'll go into the offense of this, people are shooting some big stuff at each other. To make these void shields powered, they have huge amounts of power consumption that are gone into
those incredible reactors. But the reason I like it this way is that one cool thing about the void shields, it gets us to where we're going to go next, is that a void shield doesn't actually fail. It's more like a breaker trips. You put enough energy into it, and eventually the breaker trips, and the void shield turns off. At which point, you can reset the breaker, and the void shield will come back on. But there's a period of time between those two things. And that period of time, horrible things can happen. One other note about void shields, though, is that void shields have varying levels of power, and you can actually find yourselves in a little bit of an issue with them. If you turn the void shield up to an 11, the problem you have is that the immaterium around your ship becomes so dense and thick that you can no longer use Vox communication in ship to ship. This would usually only happen with like a battleship or something at that size. Could find itself actually silenced in battle if it wanted to bring its defenses all the way up, which is a cool, and there's some stories of this happens. It creates a weird dichotomy for a captain where he's now got to fly and fight blind, like effectively blind, because he's surrounded himself with immaterium. He can, you know, he can shoot out of it, but that's about it. The next piece down in this is, of course, how all the ships are constructed. And they're constructed of two materials. One of them is the plasteel, and that's just the 40K version of metal. This is your basic structure. But they're also covered in a layer of Wolverine.
Whoa. You're saying layer. Don't say it like they're gold plating things. These are meters thick adamantium on ships that are kilometers long.
These guys went in and got all of the different versions of Wolverine, which if you haven't seen the latest Deadpool, you're missing out. And then melted them all down and then coated their ships in them. And
The adamantium, of course, the bigger the ship, the more the adamantium. The thing about this, though, is GW does do a kind of a clever thing here in the writing. They don't just say, well, these ships are covered in dense armor, because you can still crack armor. They added something else, and it's called a field brace.
Layers.
And I love the field brace.
This is so cool because, okay, the Imperium is not the highest levels of tech in the 40K world. However, we build the biggest stuff. And when we build, we redundancy everything. And I love this with the field braces, because you have layers upon layers of fortifications, but structural force fields. You have these ships that can just go into it. But I loved it, the example of when you see it, especially in the games and the writing, there's ships that are almost cut completely in half that are fully functional, still fighting in a battle.
Yeah, and that's what a field brace does. The field brace is a energy weave that goes throughout the entire hull of the ship. So should the ship get hit with something that could crack it and put a, you know, it, and put a seam through it, remember, you are in outer space. There's inverse of gravity. So if the inside of a ship is pressurized and a crack appears, the ship will actually explode outwards. That's how, you know, that's how the laws of physics work. What the field braces do is, even if that crack is there, it forces the pieces back together and holds them there, which allows the ship to almost bend with impact should the void shields be down. This also has come up later when we talk about Nova cannons and helping the ship fire some of its biggest guns. But the field braces are really cool. So your void shield goes down, the breaker's tripped, you go to reset the breaker. As the void shields are coming up, you're going to be taking, we're about to talk about some of the guns, you're going to take some hits. And those hits are going to be centralized to crack your hull. But even if your hull cracks, the field braces may allow it to stay intact. So then when your void shields come back up, you're still as able to fight and maneuver, maybe a little bit slower as you were before. But I've held Brad back long enough. Let's talk about guns.
Boom, boom, big guns. Woo! I love my Imperium ships. While my Eldar ships are sleek and look cool, and they probably make more sense, the Imperium packs more guns per square inch than anyone else in the game.
The gun in Fifth Element is basically how the Imperium makes everything. Yes, that's how this has to go. And it's amazing. We'll start off with the biggest. It's actually not the biggest guns.
The
biggest. Yeah, is the side batteries. And the side batteries use something called macro cannons, because GW were under a time restriction, had to write something down really quickly. They say, well, hey, what's a big gun? Macro. It's a macro cannon. All right. So now that's what we have. We have macro cannons. I like that these side cannons, they do vary a little bit, but effectively, it's the same gun they use for orbital bombardment, they use for ship-to-ship bombardment. This is a man of war's battleships, all the stuff from the, you know, like British Navy, actually anyone's Navy in like the 17th, 18th, 19th century, bring the ship alongside, stick every gun out of every hole, fire all of them. Some of it's going to hit. And when it does, it's going to suck.
Because these things are. The ordnance that they're firing is bananas. It is so crazy on this.
Well, and it is just like, you know, you expect. They have a varying level difference of shells they can put in there depending on the opposition. There can be void weapons, plasma, melta, whatever we're dealing with. Because, for example, Tyranids don't have void shields. So you don't need to fire anti-void weapons at Tyranids. You have to fire things that melt organic material. But Necrons have their own style of force field you have to be able to shoot into. So the ordnance can be changed out, obviously, but the main goal of a side battery is to pull up alongside. The problem with that, though, is when you pull up alongside something, it also has guns all along the side of it if it's the Imperial vessels. So you've got a little bit of a challenge in how you want to use them, which leads to the Imperium and everyone else using smaller craft that are designed to go quick so you can never get alongside of them, and they stay in better areas, and they just kind of peck at you with their
They're trying to put down a lot of your weaponry, or they're trying to put a lot of times they focus on your weaponry on certain parts of the ship, effectively creating blind spots. And to deal with this, they have 360 mounted laser weapons. And these are
called a lance battery. Yeah. So this is the lance battery that you'll see. It is 360 degree mounted, and it is designed to do two things. One, screw up small craft, but also it can be used to what Brad was describing really well, kind of pinpoint certain parts of an enemy vessel, maybe take out their engines, take out, you know, a communications tower. It's going to, because it's much more accurate. These side batteries are just almost blind fire. You just get along close, fire them all. What hits, hits, and what misses sucks to be somewhere else in the galaxy, whenever it gets there. But these ones are designed for, their shields are low enough, we can get through them. Let's pick at them. So the lance batteries will umph, but lance batteries are for little pew-pew.
Lame. Let's talk about when you mount a gun to the prow of the ship. Whoo! And then go, well, how big's the gun?
This weapon is over 200 meters long. So that's two non-American football fields. To an American, this is two Costcos back to back. You know, but it doesn't say, I love you when you go past it. These cannons are Gauss cannons. It's just, and they fire a warhead that can be 50 meters wide, which for an American, that's two basketball courts wide. It's, which by the way, when you read that, you go, yeah, no one shoots anything that big. I mean, that would probably do enough damage to a planet, let alone for ship to ship. But I
heard GW was doing this. And there are planet killers on that, because the Don, yeah, Abaddon brought his original planet killers out, and that's what they were just forward, yeah, shooting. But one of the biggest things of this, see, three for one, is that when you mount something gigantic, that you have to go, hey, if we push a ton of force back, we probably need some, yeah, force forward.
So this is actually one of my favorite things, because every now and then GW does, I can tell, sometimes there's someone writing the rules who has a degree in physics, and I can tell when I'm reading the rules. This is one of the good ones. They realize there's a recoil. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The use of the Nova cannon causes two big problems. First is the vibration, and second is the counterforce. And for this reason, the Nova cannons can only be mounted on battleship or higher vessels. We should mention also that the Nova cannon can crack a cruiser with one shot with its void shields up. It'll go right through the void shields and blow the cruiser in half. So these things can sit at the back of a battle and just pick off enemy craft. Now, the reason it has to be on a battleship is, well, as we talked about earlier, the field braces. This requires a level of field braces that are so powerful that only a battleship would have them, because as this gun fires, it's going to effectively shake the entire ship, and it would actually shake the ship apart if you didn't have strong enough field braces. But the funnier one is firing this projectile that's two basketball courts wide out the front makes the ship want to go in the other direction. And if you put this on something, it could actually fire the ship. I mean, it wouldn't be a light year, but it might be a couple miles backwards, where there might be other ships in the way. So instead, in order to fire the Nova cannons, you have to take your battleship and turn it to full forward force so that when you fire, the ship doesn't shoot backwards. The other part I love about these is that the Nova cannon, this is how messed up this weapon is, was never used until the Horus Heresy. It was actually Petarabo who was, when he was chasing Korax, fired it at him. And even Korax went, what the hell was that? Because he missed, because it's Petarabo, because of course he missed. And after the shell went past, Korax went, what the hell was that? And it was after that moment that the loyalists and the traitors began using them, and they're still used to this day.
This would cause a lot of collateral, because you miss and you're like, oh, something behind me is going to get ruined.
Oh, yeah. It's space. So it's got to get slowed down by gravity. Or if it doesn't, it might just slam into a planet and then they have a dinosaur extinction event.
Oopsie daisy.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the ones that are probably, are they the most used? Torpedoes. So all actually factions in 40K have different torpedo types between plasma, void, melta. They've got
Space Wolf.
Space Wolf.
Literally, Space Wolf. Not type of torpedo, just a Space Wolf.
Yeah. We've got everything from boarding to damaging. And I like this a lot because they have tons of different, and this is the catch-all. Torpedoes are a lot of the things that they use in the stories to do something specific for the story.
Yes. It's a concept of the torpedo is to independent projectile. But in the 40K universe, they have void torpedoes, plasma torpedoes. They've got all those ones. But they also have hollow ones. And they're primarily used to either board a ship or put something on a ship that the ship doesn't want on it. And my favorite example of this with the boarding torpedoes is they're used by all different groups. But if you watch the very first Astartes video ever made, that's a boarding torpedo where they come in, they go into the ship, and the Space Marines pop out and begin fighting. There's been a few animations around this. I don't know why I love these animations of guys just riding a ship into another ship and then jumping out and blasting their way through. What they'll do is once they're inside, because this is a cool way to take a ship out. If you're thinking about a cruiser or a battleship style vessel, you want to do one of two things in combat. You want to blow it up or take it over. And trying to fire through all the armor to blow it up is actually pretty hard to do. So the best thing to do is actually just get onto the ship and go to the reactor and flip the overload switch and jump out. But if it's not that scenario and you want to capture the ship, let's say it's a Blackstone Fortress, for example, you can't just shoot at it and expect that the Chaos Marines inside will say, fair enough, guys, we surrender. Go ahead and have the ship.
Yeah.
No, they're going to crash it into Cadia. So maybe next time, instead of doing that, board the ship and stab Abaddon.
And this is
don't get out there.
This is such a cool thing, though, for the games and the lore, though, because of the fact that this is where you get these heroic boarding parties by the Marines that come in and just fight against all odds and fight their way all the way to the bridge and or blow the ship up. It's funny because the Marines go to the bridge more often, and like naval breachers and stuff almost always go somewhere to put explosives and leave.
Yeah, we're just going to blow this thing up. We're good, guys. This ship's full of Space Marines. That wasn't going to go well for me, or Chaos Cultists. So I'd say we just blow it up. It actually makes more sense. From there, though, let's talk really quickly about some of the ships. Again, the goal here is, if you want to know more about this, by the way, guys, I said before, you can download the PDF of the Imperial Fleet Gothic rules. It's 20 years old now. You're not really stealing anything. That's what I'm saying. There's so much lore in there. But what I do want to do is, the goal of this cast was to kind of give people some interest, something they don't know a lot about, but also for people who play the game and read the novels to know when they say something, what it is. Because I know when I read the books, a lot of times I had to go Google stuff where it's like, wait, this is a frigate or this is a corsair. Like, what is this? So real quickly, I just want to kind of run through some of these and explain what they are. So the largest, obviously, are the phalanx and those ones. So skipping them, things that are actually produced. The largest is the battleship class. And the class goes down in size all the way from the Apocalypse down to the Graia and the Adjudicators. Those aren't names of ships. Those are sizes of ships. These things are huge. So 8 kilometers long. So which is about the distance. It's 1.5 times the distance that someone goes for a run and then tells you about, and you have to pretend you're impressed.
Yeah. You know what I am impressed about is the crew size. We were talking before. Some of these are in the millions.
Yeah, you can have the battleships can be upwards of 3 million people sitting on them. They create their own gravity this size. These are incredible. Now, there were not very many of them. Every segment only has a few of them. However, the return of Gilliman has shifted that a little bit. Gilliman and Call are now overdriving the AdMech, and they're realizing that they need, especially after the fall of Cadia. Cadia would not have fallen had the Imperium had more battleships able to handle something like a Blackstone Fortress coming in. It was only because the Blackstone Fortress was so large and only the Phalanx got there in time, but they needed more firepower. So this is shifting, but for now, the battleships are very rare. And so in battle, what they do is they tend to keep the battleships a bit further back so that it can then deploy its Nova Cannon and all those things and just try to rip apart an enemy fleet.
But what are the things go to the next sizes? Because battleships can't be deployed solo. They need all their auxiliary escort ships to handle all of the nonsense, because while they're awesomely powerful and huge, you could just stick and move them for a long time. If
they're so slow. They are so slow. I mean, and it's just like we do today in modern era. We have carrier groups. We don't have battleships anymore. Same concept as a carrier group. The aircraft carrier itself can level a city, but a bunch of small little BS craft, it's kind of a pain in the ass for the carrier to handle it. So we have to bring down the next class. The next class down is called the cruisers, which is actually four different classes. You have grand cruisers, battle cruisers, heavy cruisers, and light cruisers. The cruisers used to make up about 80% of the Imperial Naval Fleet. Like I said, that's diminishing now because it's more of a focus on battleships. They were so common because the cruiser is the rhino tank of the Imperial Navy. It's one basic chassis that they just tweak a little bit and add some extra crap to.
And everybody had, this is actually an STC.
Yeah. That's right. It is an STC. The core of the cruiser is an STC. And they make fast maneuverable firing platforms, the kind that you deploy against other cruisers or against battleships to kind of maybe go after their engine compartments so they stay out of range of their big guns. They'd have heavy platforms that would actually, they couldn't handle a battleship, but they could blow up other cruisers really easily. They also have ones that are just stripped troop transports. Like, hey, we have to get the Imperial Guard into conflict. We're going to have to land this ship on a planet that's going to be firing orbital cannons at us. Let's just, load it up. And more. Of the group, though, interestingly enough, the light cruiser is the most produced, which is the smallest. I mean, it's all basic chassis, but they just put the least amount of crap on it. This is a Dauntless, and the Endeavors fall into this, and they're called a scout class. And that's because what they do is they tend to scout out at the front of the formation to start harassing the enemies, designed more to kind of get the enemies focused on them while the big heavy hitters get into position.
Which is funny because they actually have crap for weapons, but they actually have fairly decent defenses besides being super fast, yeah. If you read about them.
Yeah, they're fast with good void shields and good, anti-torpedo technology, all that stuff. But the goal of them is to basically harass a little bit, and then things like, the Armageddon and Mars Pattern grand cruisers then are behind, putting themselves in position to then wreck the enemy force.
Which I love these because these are exactly the opposite, where you're like, how are your fortifications? Meh, but I have a truckload of guns.
Yeah, I also just want to take this moment to point something out. The Imperial Navy's tactics are so much better than the Imperial Guard tactics. Oh, I mean, like it's 1,000%. Insane difference versus the Imperial Guard of, hey, how many more regiments do we have? 50? Keep next one up. Let's see what happens. Beyond the cruisers, though, there is one more class down, which is the frigates. Now, the frigate class, these are destroyers, corvettes. These guys are never alone. They're usually only used for small patrols. So as we said before, the Imperial Navy's job is to also patrol the segmentum, do small escorting duties, those types of stuff. That's where you're going to see more of your cruisers. Your cruisers are going to come along with maybe a couple frigates, somewhere in that range. And they're going to be handling, we heard there was a disturbance on World 47325. They'll go out there because it's probably a pirate incursion. And there's more than enough firepower here to deal with a pirate incursion. But if they get there and it's a Necron Tomb world, there'll be an astropath message back. That's all that's coming back. But there'll be an astropath message back. I think if you like the stuff that's kind of we just kind of lightly touched the surface there of this. Again, Battlefleet Gothic Armada 2 is available on Steam right now. I do have it. You can download, if you just want the book, Google Battlefleet Gothic Rules PDF. You will find it. It's available out there. I don't feel like we're stealing when a game is 27 years old and hasn't had enough.
It's good to go.
It's a really cool game. I like it a lot, especially if you like turn-based. The last bit I want to get into, and this is to tie into the lore and the books, is the rankings and the people within the Imperial Navy. Because when you're reading Gaunt's Ghost, you're reading Eisenhorn, you're reading Kaifas Kane, you're reading any book where they tend to interact with the Imperial Navy a lot, and they just throw out
guys' titles quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, but they never explain what they are. So I'm going to do that now. So we'll start off with the Imperial Navy. The very top, you have the Lord High Admiral. And the Lord High Admiral is, as we said, this is a Lord of Terra. This person is completely a figment of lore. They have a name, but it doesn't matter who they are.
This guy means for the average person as Santa Claus. He just probably can't.
Exactly. Yeah. He exists. His job is to make sure that The AdMech provides ships. The Lords of Terra approve funding. The Imperial Guard, the Ecclesiarchy, whatever major crusades that they have to agree to, that's their job. That's it. Now, they are, the next group down, though, is more interesting. And that's where you get to the Lord High Admirals. These are the guys that run the Segmentum. These ones are more interesting to me because they actually do have an interaction lore. Because these are the ones who will decide the size of the battle fleet. They will decide what goes where, how much goes there. So they start actually getting more involved in the planning and the structure. They may even have a vested interest in a certain crusade that is going on, because perhaps it was even their idea to launch said crusade.
They reference these guys quite a bit on this in some of the codices, especially when you talk about the guard codice on that, which is... they kind of just go, which ones are good and which ones are bad? Because if you have a great Lord High Admiral, he probably kept and is proactive on keeping the peace and putting things down. Mm-hmm. And then you have the bad ones. Things happen.
Yeah. And then beyond them, you have admirals, vice admirals, rear admirals. All of these are the people who run the ships. And so these are, sometimes you'll have an interaction with them. Sometimes you'll read about an interaction with them from the main character of the book who's having an issue on the ship. Happens, I think, the second Gaunt's Ghost book, if I'm not mistaken, where he has to go to the Lord and say, hey, we're having a war inside of your own ship. Is that cool? No? Yeah. Okay.
It's still happening.
Yeah. The next tier down are what are called the warrant officers. The warrant officer has a title, a shipmaster, gun captain, sergeant at arms. These are the things that they're in charge of. And the warrant officer's job is to oversee a critical part and function of the ship. But what I love about the warrant officers is that function that they're overseeing is always handled by the enlisted class. And the warrant officer comes from the enlisted class. I love this because every warrant officer only has their warrant because they rose up within the enlisted class to really show themselves to be experienced and knowledgeable. But it also means that whatever they're assigned to as a warrant officer is what they were as an enlisted class. So if you are the gun captain of the ship, that means you were a gunnery soldier. Or if you're the sergeant at arms, you were security. If you're a shipmaster, you were in navigation. And so this does two things. One, it greatly improves the efficacy of whatever they're controlling, but also makes for cool stories. Because now this is someone where, hey, this gun is failing, and the warrant officer is the one who runs over and fixes it and gets it moving. I just think it's a cooler narrative when the guy in charge is like, yeah, I'm also the best mechanic you guys have ever seen. Check this out. And I get it going. Below them, though, we move into what are called the ratings. And these are just the general troops of the ship. And the ratings do... So
you mean everyone else, the entire crew?
Exactly. They are the workforce of the Navy. They drive the ship. They fire the guns. They cook. They clean. They also fight. And I'll get to the voidsmen in a second. Cool thing on them before I jump in is these guys are almost all volunteers. They actually pays really well being on these Imperial vessels comparatively.
You got to think. A lot of these, again, life, we've did this before, life in the Imperium for a lot of these worlds is a nightmare. And being on a ship for this is considered wildly better than what you're doing right now.
Oh, yeah. That's not even close. You're going to live longer. You're probably going to have, believe it or not, living on this ship, you'll have a larger space to live in.
Yeah.
You know, your quarters are probably better. Everything's better. But yeah, they're well paid. They're well compensated. It's actually a pretty good gig. So they actually do very well. And that's why there's so many of these ratings. They tend to be easy to find because every planet's like, yeah, I'd like to leave now if I could go there.
Because you're like, wait a second. Do I want to leave my nightmare world? Yeah. Whatever you're offering, I'm good.
Now, within the ratings, there are really 90% of them are just the workers in the ship. But the last 10% have models in the game, and I own a bunch of those models. And those are voidsmen. Imperial Navy Breachers and voidsmen. Actually, I have both of them and a good number of them.
Because I build weird armies. So many of them.
I build weird armies. But the voidsmen, Brad and I were discussing earlier about when we fire boarding torpedoes into a ship and Space Marines pop out, or Imperial Navy Breachers, voidsmen do. That's this other group. And so these guys are masters at ship-to-ship combat. And they do two things. They defend the ship against invaders, and they invade other ships to blow them up from the inside. Big fan. They're also the security force in the ship, but that's the lazy part. Who cares about
really
that?
Really good saboteurs.
Yeah. Now, there is one other class, though. Remember how I just said that it pays really well to be there? It does, but there are some jobs you can't pay someone to do. And that's what the indentured workers are for. The indentured workers are taken in via press gangs off penal colonies. So you did something bad on your world, or were accused of doing something bad and got convicted of it. But either way, you're there. And a big ship lands. And you think, hey, that's kind of interesting. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself in the bowels of said big ship, working on their engines while they're still running.
Or their super toxic guns, because sometimes we fire crazy things that are supposed to break up the ship and everything else. Hey, welcome to Rad Guns, AdMac, thanks. But also remember, I'm giving this. I did this on our first one that didn't get out, and I'm doing it again now, which is one of my favorites, is yes, they get the penal colonies, but like if they've taken heavy losses or people have died they need to replace, don't go out to eat or go for a drink near the docks when the big ships show up.
Oh, yeah, no. They'll grab anybody because once they're off-world, come find me.
Exactly.
The cool thing about these indentured workers, though, is in the lore, they do come up a lot. They come up in two areas. First off, they become really good knowledge centers for like the Inquisition and whatnot because they know what's going on in the bowels of the ship. Because the indentured workers work in places that the rest of the ship doesn't want to go. Yeah, like the voidsman guards basically stand outside of the section that the indentured workers work in. And they'll go in if they have to, but they tend to just hang out on the outside. And
let's talk about another reason why they come up in the stories quite a bit. Because this is also just prime breeding ground for Chaos Cultists.
Yeah, this is why the voidsmen have to stand just on the outside. Because they have to go in there and deal with the Chaos Cult that just formed on the inside of a ship.
Or the Gene Stealer Cult, where a Primarch shows up and goes, so no one's going to come down here and I can just infect everybody? All right.
This seems fun. So the indentured workers are kind of, again, they're super messed up, but they get used in the lore a lot. So I'm going to bring them up. But I think that's probably a good enough coverage here. I hope all of you did find this interesting because, as you can tell, I like it a lot. It's as cool as hell to me. But the goal here was just to kind of cover space travel enough and explain some enough so we can do everything we've been doing over the course of the cast. Because we're always building towards more stuff we can cover. Every piece of information we give you means it's something that we don't have to recover again later when telling a bigger story. And next week, we're going to do just that. Next week, we're going to begin our coverage of the War of the Beast. Probably about three casts. I haven't written them all yet, so I never know how long it's going to go. The idea is to start from the very beginning, actually the prehistory of the War of the Beast, all the way up through the conclusion of it, and the way that it just completely changed the Imperium.
Great story. So, but you know what it also includes a lot of? Lords of Terra.
Plural, because we're going to have to cover some changes to the Lords of Terra that occur as a result of it. Yeah.
A lot of them die. So, I mean, I'm cool with
all of them, Brad.
Yeah, but all of them died and then they got put back in.
And they got new ones.
And then they got new ones. And then some more died.
Yeah, it's very fun.
We lost 150% of the Lords of Terra at one point in time here.
Yep. Yeah, and we're still at 100%. So we're okay.
Yay. Yeah.
So next week, Brad's going to complain a lot and that'll be fun. But this has been John Barsotti and Brad Chester.
This guy.
We'll see you guys next week.